Welcome to the KMUD News. I'm your news director, April Lewis, and I'm glad to be with you for this broadcast. On this episode, we have in-depth coverage on the continued bentonite slurry investigation in Southern Humboldt, Arcata rejecting new vacation rentals, and an interview with a UC Berkeley researcher on the impacts of cannabis farming on watersheds. But up next, a quick rundown of local headlines. This is KMUD News. In the Trinity Alps, Shasta Trinity National Forest firefighters responded to assist in the rescue of a hiker who was injured in the Trinity Alps wilderness on Sunday. The hiker was injured around 1:30 p.m. Sunday, about 3.5 miles up the Canyon Creek Trail. The hiker sustained a broken ankle and was unable to self-rescue. Due to a lack of cell phone coverage, the injured hiker and her companion were unable to alert authorities about the situation. Another hiker, who was on their way down the trail, was able to notify authorities at about 4:30 p.m. Forest Service firefighters from Engine 334 responded to assist Trinity County Search and Rescue and the California Highway Patrol. The hiker was given basic medical care before CHP evacuated her via helicopter to safety and further medical attention. The condition of the hiker is unknown. In Humboldt County, the County of Humboldt recently received the final draft of the audited financial statements in single audit for fiscal year 2024 to 2025. This is a significant milestone as staff and independent auditors completed 6 years of back audits in just over 3 years, bringing the county back to a regular audit schedule for the first time since the pandemic in 2020. Being behind on audits carries serious risks for agencies, including pauses in federal and state funding, being flagged as a high-risk auditee, and even having a negative impact on the county's credit rating. The county experienced some of these consequences while audits were past due, and getting current is the most important step towards preventing future impacts. Every audit provides important lessons about the county's accounting practices, and the audits conducted over the last 3 years, in particular, have reportedly led to positive changes in how the county manages and reports its finances. The next audit for fiscal year 2025 to 2026 is due on March 31st of 2027. Also in Humboldt County, the Humboldt County Department of Public Works is preparing for construction work on Myrtle Avenue beginning Monday, June 15th through mid-August. The portion of Myrtle Avenue between Hall Avenue and Freshwater Road will be under one-way traffic control on weekdays from 7 a.m. through 5 p.m. Motorists should expect delays of more than 15 minutes. Construction will involve removing and replacing asphalt surfacing, as well as completing drainage improvements. Commuters are asked to follow all traffic devices and signs within the construction area and allow for extra travel time when possible. If you have any questions or concerns regarding the project on Myrtle Avenue, you can call 707-445-7448. And now to our main stories. This is KMUD News. Bentonite spills into Redwood Creek and the Southern Eel have been an ongoing story since it was first reported last week. On this broadcast, we can share additional details. KMUD News reports. Starting last week, KMUD News has reported on a bentonite spill in Southern Humboldt, impacting Redwood Creek near Bryceland and the Southern Eel River. We broke the news last week that the substance is likely bentonite, a non-toxic clay used in drilling applications that can have environmental impact on our watersheds. We also shared breaking news on our last broadcast that California Water Boards stated the bentonite contamination was due to drilling activity as part of a last-mile broadband build-out along Highway 101. This has led to more questions than answers, and much was in the air and unconfirmed as we shared the Water Board's latest information with you last night. Based on our own research, and also that of Redheaded Black Belt reporter Lisa Music, we can now share more of what we know. we have more assurance that the bentonite in question is TruBor and Supergel X, both of which are bentonite-based drilling fluids. We also have additional information from California Water Boards that excess drilling fluid was taken from the work site and dumped in two local locations. The first dump site was a property in Bryceland Road who made an arrangement with Direct Drilling, a subcontractor based in Oregon, to have the excess bentonite slurry dropped on their property. It was a large amount, with 8,000 gallons of drilling slurry reportedly dumped for every day of work, which was during the full week of May 25th. Waterboard engineer Adona White reported rocks downstream being visibly coated with the substance during inspections on June 2nd and June 4th. KMUD News has reports of the exact property in question on Bryceland Road, and we reached the owner via cell phone today. However, the owner became unresponsive and hung up their phone quickly once they learned it was KMUD News calling. We also tried calling again later in the day and were sent straight to voicemail. And that inbox was unfortunately full, so we weren't able to leave a message. The second bentonite dumping location was at the Meadows Business Park in Redway and was used beginning June 1st. California Fish and Wildlife took photographs of this site and it showed it was full of a gray slurry. Neither of these dump sites have any known permits for the dumping of large amounts of bentonite slurry. Arcadian Infracom is the St. Louis-based company that was hired to build out this fiber internet infrastructure, and they also hired North Sky Communications, who then hired Direct Drilling as a subcontractor to perform work. It's quite the web of companies and contracts. Arcadian received a notice of exception from Caltrans District 1 8 weeks before the bentonite discharge, which allowed them to skip any environmental review process. The Caltrans document states that the project would, quote, not cause a significant impact to the environment. There was no plan, as far as we know, for dumping any excess bentonite drilling slurry involved in that review process. We also know that law enforcement is involved and part of the ongoing investigation. Here's a statement from today, June 9th, from Peter Tira, Information Officer for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Peter states, quote, CDFW's Law Enforcement Division was among the first to respond to the situation and is still involved in the investigation. However, I'm told that Humboldt County and the Water Board are the lead entities investigating the spill/dumping and any environmental impacts. The initial site where the event occurred is on private property, though the substance made its way into Redwood Creek into the South Fork of the Eel River. We'll bring you more information on this continuously evolving story in future newscasts. KMUD News truly appreciates the level of engagement from members of our community over this issue, and we're staying on top of it in coordination and with current questions posed to local agencies, state agencies, and our source networks. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. There's concern about neighborhood impacts of vacation rentals, and that figured into the Humboldt County Planning Commission's denial of a permit for one. Daniel Mintz reports.
Given a choice between the out-of-town owner of an Arcata-area vacation rental and a neighbor with complaints, Humboldt County's Planning Commission sided with the neighbor. Neighborhood impacts of short-term rental or STR units figured into the commission's June 4th denial of a special permit for an STR on Pepperwood Lane close to Arcata's city border. On the surface, conditions look appropriate. The STR is located on a comparatively spacious 2.5-acre parcel in a heavily forested area and isn't within 600 feet of another rental. But it's close to a residence, and there's a zoning issue. The parcel is zoned for agriculture, which kicks in a requirement to get a special permit if one or more neighbors request a hearing. And the STR's neighbor put in a hearing request due to noise and other issues. Amy Gonzalez owns a company called Humboldt Retreats, which manages 70 STRs in the county and represented the permit applicant and STR owner who lives in Concord. She acknowledged the neighbor's noise concerns, but described them as being resolved.
She's indicated that, you know, there was some stress on her end regarding the noise from parties at the, not an actual party, but like people that were there at the unit, where I immediately was responding to the guests, letting them know, hey, we're totally uncomfortable with this, you need to shut it down, and they did. And the neighbor in texts and in correspondence suggested that yes, it had quieted down, I had done my job. I respect the neighbors and I want to make sure that we are working together at all times to make sure everybody's happy and we're in compliance.
She added she was, quote, assuming everything seemed copacetic between us since then. It's not. The neighbor, Elizabeth Oliver, described her experience.
On a nightly basis, I can see upwards to 5 to 10 cars per visit sometimes for this rental. I experience people playing beer pong, staying up all hours of the night. I do text Amy. Trust me, I do. And I really appreciate her help. But it's continuous. No one is following the guidelines of the Good Neighbor book. No one is. Like, everyone is up all night. Like, I got home from work at 10:30 last night, and people are hanging out in the hot tub that backs directly up to my home. I have two little girls that need to wake up for school that have their bedrooms that face this patio. I can't even open their window at night because of the noise.
Commissioner Peggy O'Neill was empathetic, saying the STR reaps an annual income of $70,000, quote, at least if not more. O'Neill questioned why Oliver would still have concerns if the issues are resolved.
To me, it's just, it seems like the owner's doing a minimal amount of effort and waiting to be told what to do, even though it's been brought to their attention that they're interfering with a homeowner's harmony in their life. I wouldn't want to have people having in the hot tub at night and my kids even seeing that. So I don't think this is appropriate. I think that the owner should have done something a long time ago.
O'Neill later added, quote, we have a person that lives in Humboldt County that owns a home and pays taxes, and I don't feel that we should put the priority of someone from out of the area who's making money on the process and interfering with our local residents' quality of life. There was some discussion on adding conditions to the permit, but Commissioner Todd Fulton said, quote, I'm more inclined to end the permit and request that the applicant resubmit once some things have been put into place. The staff recommendation was to approve the permit, but senior planner Cliff Johnson said, because the short-term rental is unpermitted and there's evidence of noise issues that have adversely impacted quality of life, the permit can be denied. And it was in a unanimous vote. The STR owner now has a few options. Planning Director John Ford said, quote, if it were to persist and were to receive complaints, it would become a code enforcement action. Or, as Fulton suggested, the owner can reapply and gain a permit if it's shown that things have been done to address the issues. An appeal to the Board of Supervisors can also be filed. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Next is our interview with UC Berkeley scientist Christopher Dillis and his research into cannabis farming and its impact on watersheds. Christopher Dillis is a project scientist for the Department of Environmental Science at UC Berkeley. He's a preeminent researcher when it comes to researching cannabis at the highest levels of academia. We spoke with Christopher on his newest published research, a paper entitled Contextualizing Cannabis Water Demand and Potential for Stream Flow Impacts Relative to Residential and Agricultural Users in Northern California. In the paper, Christopher and his fellow researchers show scientific evidence that cannabis does not use as much water as other forms of common agriculture. This goes against many long-held beliefs by those opposed to cannabis farming, especially in Humboldt County. We're going to include a short snippet of our over 45-minute interview with Christopher from today, June 9th. We'll also be showcasing a long-form broadcast of our in-depth interview during the 5:30 p.m. public affairs slot on Tuesday, June 16th. Here's a short piece from our interview with cannabis researcher and scientist Christopher Dillis.
The current research you published on contextualizing cannabis water demand and potential for stream flow impacts relative to residential and agricultural users. I'd love to know, kind of based on the research questions you initially posed here. So, you know, specifically the first one, how does cannabis compare to other water users in terms of overall demand, seasonal demand, and spatial and interannual uniformity of demand across the landscape? What were the kind of the biggest takeaways from your research as far as that question goes?
Well, for that one in particular, we were kind of excited to finally, you know, to repeat the title, put cannabis in context, right? Because it's always been one of these things that it's, you know, I don't want to say a newcomer because it's been around for a while, but, you know, it's relative to just people living, you know, so residential water use and then, you know, non-cannabis agriculture in these areas. I think for a long time, people, you know, intuitively and accurately understood that cannabis was not the main water user, especially in these kind of more rural parts of Northern California. And so, you know, the work, I would say it's novel in the sense that it's affirming those sorts of intuitions that I think a lot of people had. And that being that cannabis is not really dissimilar from other agricultural crops in terms of its water use. And given that its footprint is so much smaller, when we put this together, you know, cannabis relative to non-cannabis agriculture just doesn't use the same amount of water across the landscape. And so instead, cannabis is kind of this, you know, I think we say in the article sort of more of like a tipping point thing. I think one of the things we found was that, you know, it was actually pretty uncommon for cannabis to cause or to you know, the estimated amount of water from cannabis to be the factor in, you know, major stream flow depletion. So when we estimate, you know, the amount of water in these catchments, we sort of create these water budgets, and cannabis on its own was, I can't remember the specific numbers, but extremely rare as the, you know, the thing of the three water users, you know, that is cannabis, non-cannabis agriculture, and residential use. Cannabis was almost never the thing causing or with the potential to cause major impacts. However, it was more so the case that it was like, if there's already a lot of water demand from the other water user types in a catchment, cannabis has the opportunity to take what's remaining. And so that's sort of more a question. And I think we get at this in our, you know, our discussion part of the paper. It's something that sort of raises the importance of monitoring how much unlicensed cannabis cultivation is in a particular catchment, you know, year to year, and sort of understanding those dynamics a little bit more about how it moves around the landscape. Because the other water users are a bit less, I guess they're a bit more permanent. There's less variability from year to year.
Does it still need to be looked at that cannabis can have these very specific stream-based impacts that aren't, you know, if you look at an entire watershed, the biggest user, but it seems like it really can impact a very specific area in a way that's larger than potentially other agriculture?
There's a lot of people in the same area. You know, there's a good opportunity for overlap among those. You know, if somebody's taking out a month's worth of water in a day, and so is their neighbor, there might be these more like pulsed events that are certainly possible. And that's actually the topic of a paper that we're working on right now. So we don't really have any like shareable results yet. Just to say that, you know, it's what you would imagine that when you sort of run these scenarios where it's like, okay, what are the potential impacts look like when it's, you know, evenly spaced and, you know, it's perfectly non-overlapping versus what does it look like when everybody in the catchment in a dense catchment takes out their entire allotment or their entire irrigation demand for a month in a week or in one event. So that's something we'll get back to you on.
What takeaways would you like to see folks have? And, or even if you're a cannabis farmer and you're in Bryceland somewhere, is there any takeaways here in terms of water use? Or is the takeaway that, my agricultural impact then is not necessarily as high as other ag users and I'm doing okay?
There's two separate audiences or markets or, the licensed versus unlicensed. And so to kind of talk about the licensed farmers, I think there's much less of it. I mean, there's just so much of a smaller footprint on the landscape. And as we all know, they're awfully closely watched, it seems. And, it's something that you can, map out pretty easily where the licenses are. And if there's not too many in an over drafted catchment, then it's really not going to be a problem. And when you're talking about like unlicensed growers, I think it's more the case of if you have a sense that a lot of your neighbors are also growing, maybe just be on the same page as to when and how much you're taking out of the stream or taking out of your well that's close to a stream or not near a stream. That sort of coordination, I think could go a long way.
We'll be playing a full-length version of our interview with UC Berkeley project scientist and cannabis researcher Christopher Dillis during our public affairs slot this upcoming Tuesday, June 16th at 5:30 p.m. In the full-length interview, Christopher goes into further detail on his research into cannabis water use, and we also delve into his earlier research on how wildfires disproportionately impact the cannabis industry. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. California Trout was recently awarded a $4 million grant to restore the Cannibal Island area in the Eel River estuary, KMUD News reports. Christine Davis is the North Coast Regional Manager for California Trout, a nonprofit focused on protecting and restoring fisheries across California. Recently, California Trout was awarded a $4 million grant to help restore the area around Cannibal Island in the Lower Eel River estuary. We spoke with Christine Davis of CalTrout to learn more. So for California Trout, why was it important to seek funding to restore the Cannibal Island unit in the Lower Eel estuary? What will the project restore, and what's the environment currently like in that area?
The Cannibal Island restoration project is important because it lies right in the middle of the Eel River estuary, and the estuary is important for fish to travel through to get to other parts of the watershed. But it's not only just a pass-through, it's a really important place for fish to pause and grow. Juvenile fish need kind of slower water with different temperature than the main stem of the eel. So it's really estuary environment is really important for the fish to have a place to stop and grow and feast on all the different wonderful macroinvertebrates and insects that live in the estuary environment that aren't quite the same in the main stem of the Eel River. So right now, over the last 100 years, this estuary had been diked and dammed to keep ocean water out. Over time, those dikes have stopped keeping the ocean water out. So you have an area that was once mostly cattle pasture for the last 100 years, and now it's being almost naturally return to its original state of estuary, but it can't quite get there. So it needs a good amount of help from a restoration project.
Will Humboldt County residents see any visual evidence once this restoration is done, or is this something that mostly occurs under the water once the project is finished?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, absolutely. Instead of, like, now you go out to the Cannibal Island Road and look at the Cannibal Island unit of the wildlife area, and you see what looks kind of like a cow pasture with a few impressions of kind of dark brown. That's the pickleweed habitat coming in from ocean water mixing on the pasture. And that'll change a good amount. You'll start to see larger channels. There'll be a public access trail where the public can walk in and out to look at the restoration site. There will also be a small parking lot and an informational kiosk to talk about the habitat restoration. That'll be an ADA. There'll be at least one ADA stall there too. You'll be able to look out at the project site and probably be able to do a little more bird watching out there too.
And then I'm also curious, just understanding a little bit more of the process of obtaining these grants. So this one was $4 million, which congratulations, from the Wildlife Conservation Board. How does that process start, and how are these grants obtained by your organization?
Yeah, well, $4 million sounds like a lot of money, because it is. A lot of these restoration projects are really expensive when they're in the estuaries. The main reason for that is just the amount of money it costs to get heavy equipment in there and actually move the dirt, move the soil around. So we've done a lot of other restoration projects in riparian areas or streams, and they tend to cost a bit less because they don't have that same level of like mushy muck to get through with big equipment. So it's just a really different, a little bit more difficult for construction crews to get in there. Obtaining the grant, we have a project team that's been working on the Cannibal Island project since at least 2022 at Caltrack, maybe before that when it started as an idea in the project team's mind. So our project team is California Department of Fish and Wildlife. They're the landowners and managers of the wildlife area, Cannibal Island Wildlife Unit.
And then the last question I had, are there any other projects in the pipeline for California trout that you would like to mention or feature that are also in the process of obtaining grants or trying to obtain grants?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Well, the Cannibal Island restoration and estuary restoration is one piece of restoration that needs to happen across the whole Eel River watershed. So what Caltrout North Coast is doing in the Eel is we're coordinating a large landscape level planning and prioritization to look at where in the watershed will be most effective to identify new restoration projects or places where conservation stewardship or landscape management might be changed or slightly adjusted to improve habitat for fish and protect ag land for humans. So we're looking at the multi-spectrum of how the watershed is used, and that's really important to Caltrout. So across the whole Eel River watershed, we're doing a big planning process, and that's underway with separate funding from CDFW. So look out for news about that, and reach out to Caltrout if you have questions or ideas for more restoration projects and conservation in the Eel River watershed.
We thank Christine Davis for her time and California Trout's efforts to restore, educate, and better maintain our natural environment in Humboldt County. That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Bianna Federico, Michael McCaskill, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. Also thanks to our reporter for this broadcast, Daniel Mintz. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can also follow us on social media at KMUD News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing or that you're curious about? Give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@KMUD.org. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.